Welcome to Keystrokes, a program about technology and accessibility. My name is Mike Haskins. For the next hour, I'll read from the AT Newswire, from AppleViz, Strivability, Tech Tip Tuesday, the New York Times, Wired, and probably some PC World there at the end. And we'll start off this week with an article from the AT Newswire. This is titled, OpenAI quietly shipped the most important accessibility architecture in a decade, and almost no one noticed. And this is written by Aaron de Blasi. On April 27th, 2026, OpenAI handed our community what may be the single most consequential interface release in a decade for blind, low vision, and disabled users. They did not call it that. They did not market it. They named the demo Chappie, dropped the source code on GitHub with an Apache 2.0 license, and let the developer community find it on its own. 2 days earlier, on April 26th, Sam Altman posted on X that it feels like a good time to seriously rethink how operating systems and user interfaces are designed. Also, the internet. There should be a protocol that is equally usable by people and agents. That post pulled approximately 1.4 million impressions in 48 hours. Most readers heard a provocation. What landed 2 days later was the answer. What Chappie actually is and is not. Let me clear something up before we go further. Chappie is not a product. It is not a feature in ChatGPT. It is not for sale. It is a wake word. The friendly persona OpenAI used inside a demo application to introduce a new way of building voice-controlled interfaces. The actual deliverable is a GitHub repository named OpenAI/RealTime Voice Component, a React reference implementation built on top of OpenAI's GPT real-time 1.5 audio model. Several technology podcasts immediately treated Chappie as if OpenAI had launched a branded consumer product. They were wrong. The repository is explicitly labeled educational and demo-oriented. It is not a promise of long-term API stability or production support, and package.json is marked private so the package cannot be installed from NPM. Developers who want to use it must clone the source and install from a local path. Why does that matter? Because if you read the coverage that existed in the first 72 hours after release and got the impression OpenAI had shipped a finished product, you missed the actual story. The actual story is the architecture. The architectural inversion that matters. For most of the last 20 years, voice agents that tried to operate web applications worked one of two ways. Either they took a screenshot of the screen, ran a vision model over it to figure out what was there, and then synthesized a simulated mouse click. Or they parsed the page's underlying HTML, the document object model, or DOM, found the element they thought matched, and then synthesized a click on that element. Both approaches share the same structural flaw. The model never controls the application. The model is pretending to be a human using the application. It manipulates a rendering of the application state, not the state itself. This introduces latency, brittleness when the visual layout changes, and limited semantic signal about what is actually happening. Real-time voice component inverts that model. Instead of the AI observing the interface, the application's tool layer hands the model a structured list of actions it is allowed to take, plus a structured summary of the current state. The model then invokes these actions directly through tool calls. There is no screenshot. There is no DOM traversal. There is no simulated click. The chess demo that traveled across Developer X, pulling roughly 1.3 million views in under 24 hours, is the visceral proof of how different this feels. When a user says knight to f3, the model does not look at the chessboard image and calculate where to click. It calls a tool the chess application has registered, something like move piece, piece, knight, from g1 to f3, and the application's own logic moves the piece. The piece moves because the application ran, not because the AI clicked something. To anyone watching, it looks instantaneous and almost magical. To anyone who has ever debugged a screen reader test suite, it looks like the future. The model is not pretending to be human. The model is calling a function. What this specifically means if you are blind. If you are a screen reader user, here is the part that matters to you in plain language. Today, filling out a state government tax form or a benefits application as a blind user usually means running JAWS or NVDA on top of Dragon Naturally Speaking or running VoiceOver and dictating into focused fields one at a time. Two assistive technologies stacked on top of an interface that was not designed with either of them in mind. The screen reader serializes the page into audio. You formulate a voice command or a keystroke. Dictation converts your voice command into keystrokes. The screen reader reads the result back to you. Each step is a potential failure point, and the cognitive overhead of operating both systems at once is substantial. The pattern OpenAI demonstrated last week collapses that whole stack to one step. Voice in, application state out. No screen reader sitting in the middle narrating the visual hierarchy. No dictation guessing at field names. The application registers each action it can take as a voice tool, hands the model the current state of those actions, and you simply say the goal. Fill in my address. Add bell pepper to my grocery list. Set my appointment to next Tuesday at 3. The model invokes the right tool. The application runs the action. Done. For form filling specifically, the most ADA litigated web interaction type, and the one that frustrates assistive technology users every single day, the demo registers exactly the operations that have been the highest friction operations for our community. Set field, get unfilled fields, submit form. The model can fill 10 fields in the order it is given them, ask you about the 3 it could not infer, and submit only when you tell it to. You never had to navigate the form's visual layout. You never had to listen to the same field labels 4 times. You never had to start over because the page reset focus. Translation: what OpenAI quietly shipped on April 27, 2026, is, whether they framed it that way or not, an accessibility argument written in TypeScript. The accessibility community has been making that same architectural argument for 40 years. Expose your application's actions as a structured, named, programmatic interface, and your application becomes usable by everyone, by screen reader users, switch users, voice control users, and now by AI agents acting on a user's behalf. The bright future of AI agents and the long-promised future of universal access converge on exactly the same point. Stop forcing the entire world to render through pixels. This pattern is not a replacement for screen readers. It is something different, a parallel path that, on applications whose developers register the right tools, does what assistive technology has wanted to do for two decades. The ADA Title II window. Timing matters. The Department of Justice's Title II final rule, finalized April 24, 2024, requires state and local governments to bring their digital content and mobile applications into conformance with WCAG 2.1 level AA. The original compliance deadline of April 24, 2026 for governments serving populations of 50,000 or more was extended by DOJ on April 20th, 2026, 4 days before it would have taken effect. The new compliance deadline is April 26, 2027. Smaller governments now have until April 26, 2028. The repository dropped on April 27, 1 week after the extension was announced. Government IT departments that thought they were out of time have been handed a year of breathing room and a new architecture to evaluate inside it. Every state and county IT department staring down a non-compliant citizen-facing portal, vehicle registration, benefits enrollment, permit applications, service requests, court filings, now has a new open-source free option to evaluate before the revised deadline. From my vantage point as publisher of Title II today, this is the most concrete near-term opportunity I have seen since the final rule was published. Title II's auxiliary aids and services obligation already covers voice as a meaningful path for residents, particularly residents with limited English proficiency, residents who cannot operate a mouse, and residents whose screen reader experience on the existing portal is broken. A tool-mediated voice agent is exactly the kind of additional path that satisfies the spirit of the rule without requiring a full visual remediation of every legacy interface. Five honest caveats worth naming. I would not be doing my job if I did not name what this technology cannot do today. 1. Non-standard speech recognition is the unsolved problem. GPT Real-Time 1.5 was trained on standard speech. Developers report that heavy accents cause language misidentification and that accuracy degrades after multiple conversation turns. That is exactly the population for whom voice access matters the most: speakers with dysarthria, aphasia, ALS, cerebral palsy, post-stroke speech changes. VoiceIt, which is spelled Voice ITT, all one word, and similar personalized ASR vendors have spent more than a decade building speech recognition specifically for non-standard speech, with personalized models that learn an individual's speech patterns. A serious deployment of real-time voice component for speakers with non-standard speech would route audio through a VoiceIt style layer first. 2. Voice only is not accessibility. It is the exclusion of a different group. Deafblind users. Users in noisy public environments. Users in libraries. Users with severe speech disabilities. The model cannot transcribe. WCAG 2.1.1 keyboard, WCAG 2.5.4 motion actuation, and the in-development WCAG 3.0 multimodality scoring all require multiple input paths. Voice as additive, a major win. Voice as substitutive, a WCAG Section 508, ADA, and European Accessibility Act exposure. 3. The README is silent on accessibility. OpenAI does not specify whether tool call results emit ARIA live announcements. They do not require microphone permission UI to meet accessibility standards. They do not require a confirmation flow before destructive tool calls. Every one of those obligations falls on the developer integrating the component. If you are an AT vendor or government IT shop, write that responsibility into your implementation plan from day one. 4. Prompt injection by voice is a real attack surface. A television in the background saying, "Delete my account." An adversary in a coffee shop speaking commands at your microphone. Destructive tool calls need confirmation steps. The tool layer needs strict user context isolation. This is not theoretical. It is the same class of risk as SQL injection, except a language model evaluates all inputs in a flat context window where it cannot structurally distinguish trusted instructions from untrusted user input. 5. The repository is small today. It is a single commit, no formal releases, and an explicit reference implementation label. Do not read this article as a claim that OpenAI shipped a finished platform last week. Read it as a claim that OpenAI shipped an architectural argument in working code with an open source license. Whether that argument becomes the dominant pattern depends entirely on whether developers, and especially accessibility developers, pick it up and run with it. What to do this week? 3 concrete actions if you build for our community. 1. Clone the repository at github://openai/realtime-voice-component and walk through the README, the demo architecture document, and the chess demos tool registration. You will internalize the pattern in an afternoon. 2. Audit one of your own products or one citizen-facing portal you own. Ask the question, what would the tool list look like? If you can name 15 actions a user might want to take, you have your starter set. 3. Treat the package as a reference, not as a dependency. The patterns are what matter. The implementation in your own React components, with your own ARIA live region pairing, your own confirmation flows for destructive actions, and your own keyboard and screen reader fallback path is what will ship. For 20 years, our community has been promised that voice would fix accessibility. It has not, because every prior generation of voice agent was just a simulator of human keyboard and mouse activity. When the underlying interface changed, the voice layer broke. When the developer had not labeled something, the voice layer could not address it. real-time voice component is the first pattern from a Tier 1 AI lab where the model does not pretend to be a human. It calls a function the application has explicitly exposed. That changes the contract. That is news. OpenAI did not call it accessibility. They called it Chappie, and almost no one noticed. And again, the author was Aaron DeBlasi. And you're listening to Keystrokes. My name is Mike Haskins, and at this time I'm going to switch over to the Apple Viz website. Got an article here titled, Feature Suggestion, Multi-Line Braille Support for Braille Access. This is written by Scott Davert. In September of last year, Apple released iOS 26, bringing a lot of new features and updates. Among those new features was a suite of options called Braille Access. Braille Access, specifically live captions, has reopened a lot of my world, and this is not something I state lightly. I have very little usable hearing at this point, which has led me to not being able to enjoy some of my more audio-centric hobbies in recent months. Live captions have reopened those options to some extent, not only with things like old-time radio dramas, but also, since I do have some residual hearing, live captions have allowed me to follow audio-described programming. While there is no one stream of both the dialogue and descriptions existing, in a sense, live captions have helped make this a lower barrier. It's also helped with things like essential phone calls and access to meetings. However, live captions exists in a single-line environment, and there is currently no support for multi-line Braille displays in Braille Access. What I've come to understand about the use of multi-line access to captioning is that it speeds up the process of following Braille at the regular rate of speech. Multi-line Braille on Windows has made it so that I can almost match the speech rate of hearing users. It does so by allowing the user to follow the flow of conversation more fluidly without having to pan each line. This also reduces cognitive load. Further, sometimes it may be necessary to pan backward with a single-line display, where with multi-line access, you can just move your finger up to an earlier line. For example, in fast-moving phone calls or meetings, having only one line of Braille can mean missing information as it scrolls away, with no efficient way to quickly recover context. Also, in September 2025, Dot Inc. unveiled the DotPad X. This is a multi-line Braille display which brings both multi-line Braille and tactile graphics to iOS and iPadOS. At the time, it was my first exposure to a multi-line device which worked well on iOS. The DotPad allowed me to take books on the go and have a multi-line reading experience, something I haven't had until that point with my Apple devices. The only thing missing now is multi-line support in Braille Access. To be clear, this lack of multi-line support for Braille Access is not available on any multi-line displays, though I'm posting this within the context of the DotPad. Multi-line support in Braille Access is also not available on other multi-line devices such as the Monarch and Orbit Slate. Having multi-line support in Braille Access would not only be great for live captions, but also so that those with access to multi-line devices can read BRF files in the Braille-first environment Braille Access provides. While I have multi-line access to captioning for phone calls on the PC, I'd much prefer to have this on my phone where I make phone calls. At a webinar I attended in February hosted by Dot Inc., Dave Williams indicated that this was a request they had sent along to Apple and have encouraged others to do the same. I have filed my feedback suggestion as, this is the string of letters and numbers to reference that one, F as in Frank, B as in Bravo, 2248 4975. Again, that's FB 2248 4975. It is my hope that Apple will strongly consider this request and that others may file feedback as well to help Braille Access become the best in class multi-line Braille experience we know Apple can deliver. And again, this was written by Scott Davert. And I'm going to switch over to Tech Tip Tuesday for a quick item here. This is titled, Using VoiceOver to Label Controls with Your iPhone. And this is written by Joe Good. Today's tech tip is really interesting. In fact, it is one I'm surprised never came to mind until fairly recently. I was talking with someone about usable apps versus accessible apps. That might be another post for a later time. In any case, what came up was the labeling of elements in applications, specifically those with unlabeled buttons. So, I figured I would discuss this from the point of view of an iPhone user. Note that you can also use this tip for labeling photos in the Photos app. What I'm about to tell you, it works. This is a feature that I use quite frequently, especially if I know that the app I'm using will be used very often. Here's how it works. First, place your focus on the button or element that you want to label. Do this with your usual swipe right gestures. Next, with two fingers, double tap and hold. After a few seconds, an edit box will pop up with the name of the element already in focus. Remove that name, then click Done in the bottom right corner. Here's a great example of this. I use the eSpeak app on my iPhone. By default, all of the sliders, volume, rate, pitch, etc., are unlabeled. They just say slider and give the percentage. So I had to figure out what each slider did. Once I figured it out, I would label the slider with its proper name. The only downside to this is that sometimes when applications update, we lose our VoiceOver label. So we have to do it again. I haven't experienced this a whole lot, but I have seen it happen. Hopefully this week's tip will be super helpful to everyone. Thanks for reading. See you all next week. And again, this was written by Joe Good. And you're listening to Keystrokes. My name is Mike Haskins, and at this time I'm going to switch over to the New York Times. Got an article here titled, Five Ways AI Search Beats an Old School Google Search. Google's AI search technology is far from perfect, don't count on it for celebrity news, but it excels at tasks like picking out groceries and detecting scams. And this is written by Brian X. Chen. When Google added a new button for searching the web with generative artificial intelligence, the feature debuted with such glaring flaws, like a tendency to make things up, that I was skeptical it would become my go-to tool for finding information online. But 1 year later, I confess that I have become a convert. Even though the technology remains imperfect, I am increasingly clicking the button labeled AI mode on Google.com to type requests and immediately finish tasks that would have required many minutes with an old school search. It took me some experimenting to get better results from AI search, and the key was to tell Google to work with a small amount of information instead of crawling the web for answers. Recently, I used Google's AI search for identifying a car part to do a repair, picking out a condiment at a grocery store, and spotting internet scams. With a normal web search, I would have had to do multiple keyword queries and read several articles to get the job done. But Google's AI essentially automated the process. A big caveat. I recommend steering clear of using AI mode as a regular search engine, looking for direct answers to questions. Google's AI often spews misinformation. Just last week, it incorrectly said a car diagnostics app could tell me whether my vehicle was ready for a smog check, a non-existent feature. A New York Times analysis found that roughly 10% of Google's AI-generated answers were wrong. Of course, an optimist would say that means 90% were right. With Google processing more than 5 trillion searches a year, that translates to tens of millions of erroneous answers every hour. In our analysis, Google fumbled with basic facts, including historical dates, names, and celebrity news. Google said the overwhelming majority of its AI responses were accurate. It disputed the Times study and said it did not reflect what people were searching on Google. It also said, regarding my issue with the car diagnostics app, that search AI technology might misinterpret web content. While we wait for AI mode to get better at answering direct questions, we can still use it for other purposes where the AI technology is already superior to an old-school keyword search. I'll walk through my favorite examples. Shopping for groceries. In my experience testing generative AI, the technology is most reliable when you direct it to pull information from trusted sources, instead of from all over the web. The same goes for Google's AI search. Take my recent visit to a local Korean grocery store as an example. I was shopping for gochujang, the fermented bean paste, and the store carried a handful of brands. I recalled seeing an episode of America's Test Kitchen that featured the cooking show's favorite gochujang brands, but I couldn't remember which ones were top picks. So I uploaded a photo showing all of the gochujang brands carried at the store and typed this prompt: which of these does America's Test Kitchen recommend? Google's AI immediately identified the bean paste on the top shelf that received glowing reviews from the show, and I placed it in my grocery basket. That was much quicker than Googling the episode and rewatching it to find the recommended brand. Ordering repair parts. AI search also excels at identifying objects, which was useful for a recent repair I did on my car. A few months ago, a relative driving my car struck a pole in a parking garage, shattering the plastic housing for a side mirror. I wanted to order a replacement part, so I took a photo showing my car and the damaged mirror, drew a circle around the broken plastic, uploaded the image into AI mode, and typed, "Identify this part." Google's AI immediately identified the part describing it as a mirror-based cover, and showed where to order it online. As a follow-up, I asked for a video demonstrating how to replace the mirror part, and the AI pulled up a relevant YouTube clip. When the part arrived a few days later, I followed the video and finished the repair in 15 minutes. Finding flight deals. While planning summer vacation, I realized that using Google's AI to search for flight deals was better than browsing travel aggregator sites like Google Flights. That's because I could tailor criteria to my personal situation, traveling with a toddler, in addition to price. For a trip to Hawaii, I asked AI Mode to look up the best flight deals in July. Look up the best flight deals to Oahu in July, I typed. Keep in mind I'm traveling with a toddler, so super late arrivals are out of the question. Google's AI suggested mid-morning or afternoon flights that arrived by 4 p.m. in Oahu. They weren't the cheapest tickets available, but they were the best value for my family. Researching products. I've also used AI search to account for my personal preferences when narrowing down options while shopping for products like a pair of shoes. I said I was searching for the best pair of shoes for my foot ailment, plantar fasciitis. Google's AI listed shoes that podiatrists recommend for people with plantar fasciitis. Next, I asked AI to present my options in a chart, and Google produced a table including the main features and cost of each shoe. I ended up ordering a pair made by Brooks that were on sale. Spotting scams. In addition to identifying objects, AI has come in handy for spotting the telltale signs of internet scams. When I suspect that an online store could be scammy while shopping, I simply copy and paste the website into AI mode to ask whether the site is legitimate. The AI has been quick to alert me to potentially fraudulent activity by pointing out red flags like a weird web address, unbelievably low prices, and poor customer reviews. Using AI for scam detection has benefited me in other surprising ways. Last month, I ordered an engine part for my wife's car from eBay. Yes, I've had a lot of car problems lately. That the seller described as genuine equipment from the manufacturer Bosch. The part arrived in a pristine Bosch box and looked like the real thing. But when I installed it, a check engine light came on. Confused, I took a photo of the part and box and uploaded it into the AI search tool. It immediately flagged the item as counterfeit because of one detail I missed. The part number printed on the car part was different from the part number on the box label by a single digit. When I shared the photos and this observation with the eBay seller, he immediately issued a refund. Again, this article was written by Brian X. Chen. And at this time, I'm going to switch over to Wired. We have an article here titled, Get Ready for More Brain Scanning Consumer Gadgets. Neurable, which makes non-invasive brain-computer interfaces, is licensing its technology and promises a flood of new third-party hardware this year and next. And this is written by Julian Chakatu. The next gadget you put on your head could scan your brain. Neurable, a Boston-based company that embeds its non-invasive brain scanning technology into hardware to monitor a person's focus levels, announced on Tuesday that it is transitioning to a licensing platform model. By certifying third parties, Neurable expects its tech to be in a flood of consumer gadgets this year and next. Neurable has until now focused its efforts on a pair of consumer-grade headphones made in partnership with audio brand Master and Dynamic. It also has a contract with the U.S. Department of Defense to see how its technology can monitor blast overpressure and potentially help diagnose mild traumatic brain injuries in soldiers. With the licensing model, we could see more of Neurable's tech in everyday head-based wearables. The headphones use built-in electroencephalography, or EEG, sensors to monitor brain waves. That information is sent to a companion app and lets wearers know when they need a brain break, nudging them to take a breather before they feel burnt out to maximize productivity. The app also lets users discover their cognitive readiness for the day, their brain age, and other metrics such as mental recovery, cognitive strain, and anxiety resilience. Wired staff writer Emily Mullen tested the original headphones in 2024, though she found it difficult to verify the accuracy of Neurable's algorithms. Now, HP-owned gaming brand HyperX is releasing a gaming headset with Neurable's technology, and it's all about improving human performance while esports gaming. The headphones are purported to help wearers ease into the right state of mind for the best performance. Ramses Alcaide, Neurable co-founder and CEO, tells Wired that the company has published a white paper showing improved performance among gamers using Neurable's tech, with reduced response times in first-person shooter games and a small increase in accuracy. The improvements may sound minor, but milliseconds are precious in the fast-paced world of esports gaming. And Alcaide says it could translate similarly to other fields. It could help a student reduce anxiety before an exam, while athletes could condition their nerves ahead of a race or game. Neurable is hardware agnostic. Alcaide says it can be embedded in headphones, smart glasses, hats, or helmets. There's a whole landscape of technology that touches your head that's yet to be embedded with our platform, he says. He likens it to when Fitbit made the idea of a wrist-worn heart rate tracker popular. In the beginning, no one knew how fitness wearables would be received, but now no one blinks an eye at one on a wrist. Soon, no one will think twice about brain-scanning tech in headphones, or at least that's the idea. Neurable's tech is invisible in these types of gadgets. Companies licensing Neurable's tech can integrate it into existing hardware, Alcaide says, and will control the entire experience from product design to the software experience. These products will be advertised as powered by Neurable AI. The user data still flows to Neurable's servers for processing, but Neurable sets the data privacy protections. User identifiers are separated from the data, and while partner companies host the user-facing layer, Neurable says it keeps control of the underlying system and data handling. Neurable has previously said its business model is not to sell user data. Anytime there's a new transition to technology, there's always going to be some anxiety, Alcaide says. We've been very careful when it comes to that transition. We are protecting the data, being as ethical as possible. Neurable is one of many brain-computer interface, or BCI, companies in the growing category. Elomind uses EEGs to improve sleep quality, and Sabi wants to turn thoughts into text. Even Apple filed a patent for EEG-sensing AirPods, though they're not yet available. Damian Coyle, director at the Bath Institute for Augmented Human at the University of Bath, says there's potential in these kinds of BCIs because people don't understand when their performance is winning. Especially with high-performing e-gamers or gamers, their reaction times are in milliseconds, and any small improvements in focus or the ability to react and ways of maintaining that for longer periods should certainly provide benefits, Coyle says. Translate that to high-stakes decision-making in the workforce, and that could be beneficial for sure. There's no word yet on exactly when HyperX's Neurable headset will land. Alcade says to expect a few Neurable partnerships to be announced this year, and more in 2027. And again, this article was written by Julian Chakatu. And you're listening to Keystrokes. My name is Mike Haskins, and at this time I'm going to switch over to PC World. Got an article here titled Windows 11 Reset. Microsoft pledges more speed, stability, and control. Microsoft drops a mega memo detailing the company's plans for Windows. We'll help make sense of it all. And this is written by Mark Hockman. Over the past few months, Microsoft senior executives have quietly made a promise to me directly, as well as to other journalists. They're going to improve Windows. Today, they're making that same commitment to the public, with an emphasis on performance, reliability, and craft. In a highly detailed memo, Pavan Devuluri, Microsoft's Executive Vice President of Windows Plus Devices, pledged a philosophical reset, acknowledging that they've listened to those who care deeply about Windows and want it to be better. What follows is our broader plan and areas of focus for the year to raise the bar on Windows 11 quality, Davuluri wrote. The work is underway. You can expect to see tangible progress that you'll be able to feel as you preview builds from us throughout the rest of the year. And yes, the changes are sweeping. They touch on everything from system performance to stability and reliability to a quieter user experience to even AI. Why does Windows 11 need a reset? Why now? Microsoft has listened to a litany of complaints about Windows and is taking action. Its improvement plan ranges from the small but important, repositioning the taskbar and improving the start menu, to more fundamental issues, streamlining the Windows Insider program and improving overall reliability. The Davuluri memo follows many months of criticism lobbed at Microsoft for a poor user experience and AI features no one really wants. Microsoft has been forced to scale back its ambitions for embedding Copilot deeply into Windows 11 after widespread pushback, shelving plans to integrate AI into core areas like notifications and system settings because users found the features intrusive, unnecessary, and emblematic of AI bloat rather than meaningful improvements. I've felt the same way as well. Increased frustration with Copilot is causing me to throw up my hands in despair. Complaining about Windows 11 can net you dozens or hundreds of supporting comments and social media points. Windows users describe Copilot and related AI efforts as forced additions that add complexity, consume system resources, and detract from performance without providing clear value. Microsoft may have made about $121 billion from its investment in OpenAI, but the sentiment is that it's wholly committed to AI at the expense of Windows 11 users. Behind the scenes, Microsoft is talking to customers, analysts, and even reporters about what it can do better. Users don't have that freedom, and the memo signals that Microsoft will improve its feedback hub, the Windows app for users to offer advice, suggestions, and complaints about Windows 11. That update should be rolling out soon. Davalori didn't explicitly say what provoked the changes, which Microsoft will roll out as part of its Windows Insider program over the next few months. Anecdotally, though, Windows users have begun looking more seriously at Linux as potential gaming options like Valve's Steam Deck, which runs Linux, as well as its upcoming Steam machine. Case in point is our own The Full Nerd podcast, which has tracked the small but growing increase in Linux gaming. If Linux wasn't popular, would the Steam Deck be sold out? Nope. For now, though, this is what Davalori is saying about its new performance, reliability, and craft mantras. Performance. We are focusing on making Windows 11 more responsive and consistent, so performance feels smooth and reliable, Davalori said. Over the course of the year, we're improving system performance, app responsiveness, File Explorer, and the Windows subsystem for Linux, helping Windows stay fast as you move between apps and workloads. Here, Davalori is addressing the criticism that Windows is laggy and unresponsive beyond just applying a series of common tweaks. The company wants to reduce the number of resources Windows consumes, including the amount of memory it gobbles up. Reliability. Reliability is the bedrock of trust, Davalori said. You should trust that your PC is going to be there and function when you need it most. Across the operating system, we will focus on improving the baseline reliability of areas such as the Windows Insider program, drivers and apps, updates, and Windows Hello. Honestly, Microsoft's famed blue screen of death is relatively rare these days. Microsoft executives tell me that the key here is the little things, reducing the amount of time your AirPods take to connect to Bluetooth, for example. Craft. To us, craft is the discipline that turns functional products into loved ones through usability, polish, coherence, and refinement, Davalori said. This year, you will see us invest in raising the bar on the overall usability of the experience, with more opportunities for personalization, less noise, less distraction, and more control across the OS. This is the area folks will notice most. Check out our other stories for the details, but Microsoft plans to work to make Windows 11 more like Windows 10, with a movable taskbar, improved start, and more. Microsoft's Davalori also added that Microsoft is evolving how Windows is built behind the scenes to raise the quality bar and deliver innovation where it matters most, shaped by the feedback we are hearing from you. That could prove to be significant, given that Microsoft reportedly tried to replace some of its human quality control efforts with AI, leading to a subjective decline in quality, according to Windows watchers. Microsoft did not say that it was explicitly hiring more human testers, however. Microsoft's small Windows Insider team also left for other jobs in the past few months. Less AI. Hooray! It's doubtful that Microsoft will get rid of its investment in AI. But the company did acknowledge the Copilot carpet bombing of AI within Windows was unnecessary, confirming reports that it would scale back Copilot's reach. You will see us be more intentional about how and where Copilot integrates across Windows, focusing on experiences that are genuinely useful and well-crafted, Davalori wrote. As part of this, we are reducing unnecessary Copilot entry points, starting with apps like Snipping Tool, Photos, Widgets, and Notepad. Between the various changes coming to virtually all aspects of the Windows experience, make sure that you read our other articles that go into more detail about what Microsoft is promising. Also, consider joining the Windows Insider program to check out all of the new features before they go live. And they do give us a link to information on the Windows Insider program, so let me give that to you. That is fave.co, so that is FAVE.co/ then the letters and numbers 4D, capital A, capital R, P3Q. So again, fave.co/4D, capital A, capital R, P3Q. And again, this article was written by Mark Hockman. And that's all the time we have for Keystrokes. Your reader has been Mike Haskins. Stay tuned for more programming on VoiceCore, your audio access to the world.